And with that, I'd like to describe some of the reasons why we think the anthropic principle has been used widely in the literature as a possible solution to various problems, say, cosmological constant problem, the coincidence problem, why this is something that needs to be treated with extreme care, and why it's something that perhaps whose results are not very, are more a reflection of what you put in on one end rather than being a prediction on itself or an explanation as it has been claimed. So what I'm going to say today is that, in extreme summary, I do not dispute the anthropic principle as such. I only say that the use that has been done so far is not logically consistent and it's extremely sensitive to the redefinition of the concept of what observers are in the cosmos, which means if you redefine your idea of observers, you get a completely different answer, as I'm going to demonstrate. In my opinion, this is not very much of an explanation, but we'll see. All right, so before I get started on the anthropic principle per se, I'd like to just very briefly review this fantastic amount of data that we have nowadays that really points towards what we call cosmological concordance. Of course, one of the main pillars of the of our cosmological model today is given by the observations of plasma background and isotropies by WMR. Here's the 3 years map for the 3 years temperature observations in colors, superimposed as well. We got the polarization measurements given by this from these lines. And from this map, we can make a statistical analysis, extract the power spectrum on the left-hand side. You see this picture many times now, I think. We've got here power spectrum versus scale. The dots are the observations, and the continuous lines investigate lambda CDN concordance. Extremely successful in fitting these acoustic peaks, which come from the acoustic observations in the universe. We also have polarization measurement now, as I was saying. Here is the correlation between temperature and polarization power spectrum. And again, the curve here is the basket model, which accounts for the observations. So the single most important factor of this is that it comes to high redshift inverse. So linear physics is beautifully suited to analyze most of this. So we understand this very well. That's why we can produce theoretical predictions that are very precise. And so, and we can, in particular, we can extract a bunch of parameters very reliably with a percent accuracy from the morphology of the peak and the structure of the power spectrum. And those parameters are the physical variable density for the relative height of the acoustic peaks, ratio of matter to radiation density, mainly from the height of the first of the plateau here and the height of the first peak. The position of the peaks on an angular scale of the peaks gives you handle on the ratio of the angular diameter distance to the scattered surface divided by the sun horizon and the scattered surface, that's to say the distance that sun could travel in the universe, and then the tilt and the height and the amplitude of the fluctuations give you the access to inflationary parameters such as the spectral thickness and the amplitude. We also have observations of the low redshift universe here, the Solar Mission Sky Survey, measurements of the distribution of 250,000 galaxies, after which, again, we can probe the paradigm for the growth of structures in the modern universe, out-directional 1.7 or so. And we can not only extract, again, the power spectrum of the distribution of galaxies, and from there, from this, the power spectrum distribution map, but recently, we can also map the position of the same acoustic scale that we saw before in the CMB peaks. The position of the peaks is imprinted as a preferential scale in the distribution of matter, of collapsed matter in the modern universe, in the contemporary universe. So here in this plot from Eisenstein et al., what they thought is the correlation function of galaxies, of the luminous red galaxy samples in the SDSS map versus Kolmogorov separation. So those are the observations here divided out by some fiducial flat model. And the different curves here show you the predictions for different amounts of variance in the universe. So if you have no variance in the universe, then you have no peak here. But if you have variance in the universe, then you've got a preferential scale here, this peak here, this bound, which is the same preferential scale as the peaks in the cosmic microwave background we saw in the spectrum before. And so this here has got exactly the same origin as a preferential scale, which reflects the acoustic oscillation scale in the universe. And now by measuring it in the CMB, we calibrate the scale by measuring it again at low redshift here. We can use it as a standard yardstick to measure distances and angular diameter distance out to different redshifts. So this here, this measurement here is the first measurement out last year years ago now. And since we know what the scale of this peak here is, we can use this to reconstruct the angular dynamical distance at a redshift of 0.3 roughly. And from this, we can measure omega matter h, not omega matter h squared, but omega matter h from the power spectrum, the ratio of variable to matter from the height of this peak, and again from the shape of the power spectrum from these galaxies. We can measure the amplitude, sigma 8, and again, the spectral peak. We also have access to luminosity distance measurements in the form of supernova type 1a, which are, if not standard candles, are standard isomer candles. So we can relate the intrinsic luminosity to the fade-out time, and the stretch factor, tells you how much time it takes for them to reach peak intensity and then disappear. This is a Hubble diagram showing the latest results by Risetol with more than 100 supernovae now out of redshift of 1.8. The most distant supernova is out here. And in this instant, then you can see this Hubble diagram divided out by what we would expect in the negative universe. So a universe with omega matter equal 1 and no cosmological constant would be a purely distributed universe now here. But we really see now that this is a turnover there. So the turnover from the data singles out the region where we had deceleration in the past, matter domination, and now there is acceleration now as power, we think, about the cosmological constant, or that energy is some sort of volume energy. So from this, we can measure the luminosity distance out of redshift of z. In this case, the effective redshift is about 0.7 or so. And if you combine all of these independent lines of evidence, and all of them, I stress the fact that they are based on very different physics and very different epochs of the history of the cosmos. And we combine them in this omega lambda, omega matter plane, where one is the units of the critical energy density. Then we have here a flat universe. The cosmic microwave background tells you that we are on this line here. It's often said the cosmic microwave background tells you that the universe is flat. It's not quite true, since the degeneracy line of the CMB is not parallel to the flat universe. So if you don't know what the Hubble parameter is, if you don't know, if you don't have an independent measurement of the other parameters in the CMB alone, you cannot really say that the universe is flat. I would say roughly on this line. But as long as you combine those supernovae measurements, with the degeneracy line is orthogonal, you combine with periodic acoustic oscillation or large scale structure data, length lensing data, then you really zoom in here into this region where we have about 70% cosmological constant dark energy and 30% matter. So here's a more precise result from recent analysis by ST et al., another the SNLS supernova group. Again, combining supernovae, that's a quantitative version of this diagram, supernovae data together with baryonic acoustic oscillation data, and really single out this region with an error of the order of 10%, perhaps. So here's the situation. We are very connected with it because it turns out that most of the units are stuff, 70% dark energy or cosmological constant. Let's focus on this and then apply now, before going on and try to explain what is the entropy principle, why it's being invoked as a possible solution to this problem. Let me just spend a few minutes discussing what the problem is in the first place. So we've got the 70% cosmological constant of dark energy. One of the most interesting and hot topics in observational cosmology now is to determine observationally whether this cosmological constant is the constant of time, whether it's back energy evolution, or whether it's modified gravity, or something else. So in general, we parameterize the dark energy in terms of its equation state, which is possibly redshift dependence on the ratio of pressure to energy density. We need it to be below minus a third in order to get acceleration on the left hand side of the Friedman equation. So if you use below minus a third, then we get positive right hand side, the universe is accelerating as indicated by the supernova data that I just showed. So the idea is to try and constrain the time dependent redshift dependence of W as a function of redshift. Of course, W equal minus 1 will correspond to the cosmological constant, as envisaged by Einstein. Or if we have positive evidence that W is the time, then we could really go and look at, say, quintessence models or those kind of things. So far, all data are compatible with the hypothesis of cosmological constant. This is the result from a recent work that we did last month, combining all the available data with novel advanced Bayesian inference technique. So this is a function of redshift. So we're sitting here out of redshift 1, actually. I'll show you another plot that goes after redshift 2 with a new supernova And that's minus one, that's what the cosmological constant is, and those are posterior constraints from the data. And you can see it's a 68 region, so it's all usually compatible with minus one. So far, cosmological constant is sufficient to explain the law. The question is, of course, where does it come from? Nobody really knows. As an explanation for the magnitude of the cosmological constant, if it was zero, then the solution would be fine, because we would look for some sort of symmetry that would impose it to zero, but it's more, and yet not zero. One way of looking at this is by talking in terms of the coincidence problem. And so, since the density matters case is the cube of the expansion factor, well, one of the cube of A, let's say, is the cube of the expansion factor, but the cosmological constant on this, well, if it's a cosmological constant, it's constant in time, it results that if we plot the log of the dominant energy form of the universe as a function of the scale factor of the inverse of the redshift, then, well, radiation scales redshifts away as redshift to the fourth power, so it was dominating in the early universe below a redshift of about 3,000, then matter took over the redshift of about 30,000, and now the cosmological constant is going to take over in the future as radiation and matter, but more redshifting away. And the question is, so the epoch here of matter lambda equality is about redshift 0.7, so relatively recent cosmological terms. The coincidence problem is then, why did it happen back then, and why do we see cosmological constant contribution to the energy density and matter contribution to the energy density being roughly the same order of magnitude right now in cosmic history? After all, if we were to make observations in a few billion years' time, we wouldn't see the influence of that matter at all, almost, because we would really not make it into a cosmological constant universe. If we were to make observations a few billion years back, before the matter lambda equality, we wouldn't see lambda at all, because its effect would be completely subdominant. So is this just a coincidence, or is this something hinting at some deeper physics, some fundamental link, perhaps, between lambda and that matter, which has been explored, of course, in particular models, such as quintessence models. In a very recent paper out of the last few days, Langmuir and Egan have argued that this is actually just a manifestation of a selection effect, which is another way of putting the anthropic principles, which I'll see in a minute. So they are saying, so here is again the same diagram with the density of the matter dropping down as a function of time and density in cosmological constant rising up. We happen to sit here on the point where the two densities are in a ratio about 3:1. And they're asking, well, why do we sit here? I mean, is there a selection effect that would explain the fact that observers, for instance, cannot, such as us, ourselves, can only arise in a certain specific time in the cosmic history? And they argue in that paper that the one possible solution is to look at this curve here. This is they claim this is the probability distribution of producing terrestrial-like planetary bodies, and you see it peaks around 10 giga years after the Big Bang, and slowly goes down, and we are here, say, the last 32% of this curve. So we, in other words, you could be observing here, because there would be no Earth-like planet and therefore no observers like us. You wouldn't be able to observe here. Well, you would, but you would not be the first observer. You would not be the first observation of lambda. So they're arguing, because terrestrial bodies form, they argue, in this way, then we must leave what can, at a certain point in cosmic history, such as we perform a first observation of omega lambda at this cosmic time. So this is an example of selection effect. I'm going to argue against, not against selection effect itself, I'm going to argue against the probabilistic procedure by which this kind of inferences are drawn. Before I do that, let me just briefly list a few more anthropic coincidences, or what have been termed anthropic coincidences, people like Eddington, Hoyle, Dirac, many very influential physicists have been surprised by looking at the fact that many dimensionless quantities that you can compute out of fundamental constants turn out to be very special numerical values, and they want to understand whether it was some sort of link. So there are a few of them that appear suspicious, and maybe that they're just the way nature is set up, or they might again hint at some more fundamental physical meaning that is common. For instance, the strength of the strong force appears to be fine-tuned in about 1%. And if it was 1% weaker, then we wouldn't have deuterium fusion. And so the Big Bang nucleosynthesis couldn't proceed at all. But if it was 1% stronger, then in stars, we would have runaway hydrogen burning, which means it's having a typical lifetime of a main sequence star of the order of a few billion years, which arguably is necessary for evolution to proceed and give you biological life forms such as ourselves. We would have a typical lifetime of stars of over a million years, which wouldn't be enough for us to exist. And another interesting coincidence is the strength of the electromagnetic force compared to the strength of gravity. It's a big number, 10 to the 40. And this number seems also to be fine-tuned to a very high extent, because the precise value of this number controls the stability of stars on the main sequence. Again, and so if this was a bit different, you couldn't be here to talk about it. The proton-neutron mass difference is absolutely crucial, of course, to the fact that Big Bang nucleosynthesis can proceed, and in particular, well, of course, it's fine-tuned about one to mean. In particular, it's the difference in the mass between the two allows for the fact that neutrons can decay in the universe, and then there's this very precise sequence of events during Big Bang nucleosynthesis that is highly dependent on this number and the value of this graph. A less obvious one is number of spatial connections. I don't have to explain to string theorists here in the audience that string theory tells us that the underlying model of the universe should bear more, up to 11 spatial dimensions. And so why do we need in 3? Why are the remaining dimensions curved up, perhaps, in curved up dimensions? Well, arguably, if a higher intelligence or any biological life form could not live or be evolved in less than 3 dimensions, at 2 dimensions would probably not have enough. You wouldn't be able to have enough complexity in only 2 dimensions to interconnect a complex brain such as our own. And in a high number of dimensions, well, clearly since gravity would leak out as R1 or RPM minus 1, we wouldn't have stable planetary orbits in anything for n bigger than 3. And so again, since this is 3, the number of spatial dimensions could be just an accident. The carbon 12 resonance was famously predicted by Frenthoek based on that topic argument. He remarked that the carbon production in stars could not proceed fast enough unless there was a specific resonance in the carbon 12 atom that would make the process proceed resonantly in a much faster time scale in order to produce enough carbon in the amount that was observed. And indeed, sure enough, this resonance was found. So, and there are many more. But many more of those coincidences. The point I want to make is, are those just coincidences, or there's something deeper at work here? Can we understand them either from a fundamental physics point of view or from a probability point of view in terms of what they mean? Well, there are a few possible viewpoints about all of these coincidences and unexplained big numbers and big number ratios. First, we can just claim that those are just reflections of deeper symmetries in the laws of nature that are yet to be discovered. But then, of course, the question is, what determine those symmetries in the first place? And in particular, especially if we take the view that the laws of physics as they are, for instance, in the kind of a multiverse that I'm going to introduce in a minute, they are not fixed, in particular, they are not necessary, then if you move to, say, entertain the hypothesis of having a collection of different universes with different laws of physics, then what would select the particular laws of physics to be observed in our universe in the first place? In other words, instead of asking the question about the laws themselves, we're asking the question about the meta-laws that govern the emergence of laws of physics in the particular universe that we're considering. So we're looking here at sort of an infinite regress of hypotheses in a more and more complicated type of way, for which possibly there would be no end in sight, unless string theory, of course, would give us the answer. The particular solution that would be turn out to be unique and necessary, which however doesn't seem to be the case anytime soon. design is another point of view. Well, the laws of physics are what they are because somebody or something, a higher intelligence, whatever, defined them to be so for our benefit. This is outside the scope of scientific inquiry, so we don't need to bother with this anymore. Some people argue that any practice we do that life is ubiquitous and will arise no matter what you do to laws of physics, but that's probably wrong. So if you imagine universes that collapse after the Big Bang in only a few years or millions of years, it's very difficult to imagine any life emerging there. And the point of view that I'm going to take now is this point of view where we have some sort of multiverse, that's to say, a collection of different realizations of a universe with different laws of physics in all of them, coupled with this anthropic principle idea that says that we must live in one of such realizations in which the laws of physics are such that we can emerge. Looks like a tautology, a circular reasoning, but it's actually not. It can be put in a very stringent mathematical form. The problem here is that this introduces a possibly infinite collection of parallel universes that are by construction unobservable. So it's from an ontological point of view, you should question what is the physical reality that's got to be attached to these unobservable universes. And that seems a little bit seems not very satisfactory from the point of view of simplest explanation. We need to introduce all of this multitude of universes that are by construction observable. So here is a cartoon depicting such a scenario, perhaps eternal inflation, where you have bundles of different universes starting to inflate out from different regions. Say we are here in this sort of collection of universes, and eternal inflation will inflate away bundles of universes in different regions. All of them have got different laws of physics in them, and we need to live in one where the laws of physics are compatible with our existence. The landscape of string theory offers another viewpoint on this. This cartoon just represents the idea that we have different solutions for the string vacua, and then every one of them will give us a different universe with different laws, different particle contents, different number of spatial dimensions, whatever. And some of them will have some observer in them, and some of them will have more observers in them, and so the ones that have more observers are more likely to be measured, and some of the ones will have lots more observers, so we should weigh the probability of this universe, of ourselves finding, being in one of those universes by the number of observers that arise in such universes. And so not all universes are equally probable. In particular, there are some universes for which laws of physics are such that we couldn't possibly have a reason, so we're not there to observe them. There are other universes like this one where there are observers, but there's no intelligence. All right. So now back to the point of the cosmological constant problem. So of course, the cosmological constant, as I said, is standing for because of its smallness. And if we just look at simple explanations of its nature in terms of vacuum fluctuations, then we expect its magnitude to scale to be of the Planck scale. And so this is possibly the most spectacularly wrong predictions in the history of science. The observed value of the cosmological constant means of the Planck scale is 10 to the minus 123. It's an incredibly small number, and yet it's not zero. How do we explain the smallness of this number from the point of view of graph? Well, we don't have a fundamental explanation for it, so perhaps we could turn to statistics and probability to understand. So one possibility, which was introduced by Weinberg in a influential paper in 1987, is that this is just a manifestation of an anthropic selection effect of the kind that we discussed before. Namely, that if the cosmological constant is much larger than what we observe, and in his original paper, Weinberg writes a bound of about 500 times what we observe, then the expansion is too fast, gravitational collapse cannot proceed, galaxies cannot form, and there are no observers to make any statement and be puzzled about the magnitude of the cosmological constant in the first place. Perhaps worth to highlight that Weinberg himself, in his PRL, concluded that since this number was, this upper bound was actually quite large, he concluded that anthropic considerations do not explain the smallness of the cosmological constant. But this number is quite larger than what we than what we actually observed. This, of course, was before observations came along to tell you that the cosmological constant was about 0.7. So here is the question, are the constants of nature and the laws of physics God-given and fixed, or can we make some sort of consistent probabilistic statement about the possibility these laws of physics and constants of nature are actually varying or changing or different across a different ensemble of realizations of the universe? And if so, can we extract useful information from the observation that we do exist in such a subsection of the mantras? There have been different ways of defining the anthropic principle. So let me just define very precisely what I mean so that we are all on the same footing and understand what we're talking about. When I'm talking about the anthropic principle, I'm taking the view, you know, about the weak, so-called weak anthropic principles. That's to say that the measured values, the physical constants in our universe, are restricted by the requirement the conditions must be met for carbon-based life forms, just like ourselves, to arise in the first place. So that's just a selection effect. Since there's nothing magical about it, there's nothing theological about it, it's not the fact that we observe that we are here, we are carbon-based life forms, what kind of restrictions does that impose on the physical condition of the universe? There are other branches of the anthropic principle that I'm not going to consider. The strong anthropic principle states that the universe must have the properties that allow life to exist. So this is much more theological in nature. I'm not going to talk about this. And the participatory anthropic principle states that somehow observers are needed to bring the universe into being in the first place, perhaps through some sort of quantum effect or collapse of the wave function, something like that. Some of those brands of the anthropic principle have then been rebranded. So that is a warp, that's a sap, that's a pap, and some of them are.
Who called the anthropic principle what you did? I mean, the last thing. We are never using this in case.
You're right, with the classification, yeah, I think this classification from Barron's particular book.
Yeah, and we even made the statement in relation to quantum mechanics, like it has nothing to do with quantum mechanics.
Sorry?
Wheeler said this thing perhaps in relation with collapse of the state vector and with quantum mechanics. So it has nothing to do with the anthropic principle.
Yes, no, I'm just putting a name on this just for simplicity, just so that we understand what we're talking about. I'm not talking about something like this. I'm talking more in terms of selection effect of the kind that are embodied in this kind of statement. So just to make sure that we understand what we're talking about. But I agree. This is those are labels that we put on views just for simplicity. Thank you. Okay, so now I'd like just to introduce this idea of selection effect in terms of probability theory and Bayesian probability theory. So we can understand the weak anthropic principle in terms of selection effect as follows. So what we are after is the posterior in terms of Bayesian statistics, the probability of observing a certain value, say, of lambda, given that life exists. So that's a posterior probability, which through the theorem is just given by the prior distribution of lambda multiplied by the likelihood function. That's the probability of that life exists conditional on a certain value of lambda. So that's just Bayesian probability statements. So we have here two pieces of the equation.
What is the difference, left side and right side in red? You write probability lambda life, and on the other side, probability life.
Yes,
lambda.
That's the likelihood function. For a fixed value of lambda, what is the probability that life arises?
Okay.
And this is what the probability of all lambda, given the fact that lambda, so we want
life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we want just to invert the probability. So now we've got two problems in order to get a fully specified problem. We want we have to define this probability of lambda. It's a priori probability, which does not depend on any observations. And there are different meanings you can attach to this. If you're a Bayesian, you will say this just reflects our state of knowledge about lambda before we make an observation. Although this is difficult in this context, because the very first observation that we make is the fact that we exist. And indeed, there is no way you can uncondition from this observation. If you're a frequentist, though, you will appeal to some fundamental theory that gives you the probability of different values of lambda as different as a relative frequency of outcome. If you take the universe, you throw the universe many times, and then you measure, and your theory should give you the relative proportion of the outcome of lambda in different parts of the universe, for instance. So, I don't want to spend much time on this because it's something that nobody has really a clue about. And usually what people do, they take what the Weinberg conjecture says, that's to say, just take this bit here to be a constant, to be uniform in lambda, and then forget about it. And encapsulate all the selection effects in the second function here, the likelihood function, which is also called the selection function. So we have to quantify what is the probability that life arises, however defined, given a certain value of lambda. So this is the bit that encapsulates the selection effects for observers. And it suffers from two different problems. First of all, we need to define what life and observers mean in the first place, and then we have to define what counts as an observer, and for instance, whether we on Earth, we count as one observer because we're a collective observer, or whether observers outside your causal horizon count, things like that. So it's very difficult, a very difficult problem. So does the anthropic principle explain lambda? Some people argue that it does. In particular, that's a work by Stark in 1995, where he takes the probability of life, the selection function here, to be just proportional to the space density of galaxies of a certain type. And he makes a certain number of assumptions. In particular, he fixes all of the constants of nature to their observed value, which has been shown by other people to be a very strong assumption. If you relax this, you can happily change the conclusion quite a lot. But anyhow, if you do this, if you just take this probability of life to be proportional to the space density of galaxies, saying the probability that life arises must be tied proportionally to the number of galaxies you have, then you get this sort of probability distribution. The probability that lambda is below 0.9, above 0.9, so what we observe is 0.7 around here, is very, very small in this approach, depending on a free parameter here, so this change. Three parameters change over two values. But you see that this probability, this selection function, peaks around, say, below one, in this reasonable value. So if Stati concludes, this assumption suggests that the small value of the cosmological constant may be explained by the anthropic principle. And I'm going to take issue with this statement right now. And I'm going to make two different, I'm going to give you two different line of arguments why I think this doesn't work. The first line of argument is that the anthropic conclusion is completely dependent, has got an instability with respect to how you define observers in this place. How do we compute the density of observers if you just don't, it's what tells us that this density of observers is just proportional to the number of density of galaxies or collapsed gas fraction? We have, Glenn and I, we have worked out a different prescription, which I'm going to show you in a minute, which gives you widely different results. Called lambda for maximum allowed number of observations. In other words, instead of counting observers, which are an indefined quantity, I argue, we can count observations, which is a physical property that we can compute on physical principles. The second point has been made by a statistician, Max O'Neill, in 2006, and he points out that the anthropic principle as it is used is inconsistent with logical reasoning, and I'm going to elaborate on that. Another point, which I'm not going to touch, has been made by people like Aguirre, saying that if you change all the parameters at the same time as lambda, then you can happily leave the universe with lambda 10 to the 17 times what we measure, and the selection effects are not at work. So that's a different point. That's a difference. So 10 to the 17. Yeah.
10
to the power 17. If you change lambda and the other quantities at the same time, it shows explicitly in a cold Big Bang cosmology that you could leave, observers can arise. In such a wildly different universe than ours. And it's got a five parameters model where it changes lambda, it changes the entropy per baryon, it changes the cold dark matter per photon, it changes the curvature scale, and something else. The amplitude of fluctuations is a critical one, initial fluctuation.
So 1017 is compared to what? Compared to?
To the value measured today, yes. To the value in our universe.
For what? For cosmological constant?
Yeah.
Then the density will be 10 minus 12, you mean, gram over centimeter cube.
Yeah.
And what kind of amplitude or perturbation you
have today? Let me see, I got a quick slide about this. Right, so this paper here, so it varies the number of the photon per baryon, the amplitude, the dark matter per photons, the leptons per photons, the lambda and the quantum scale. And this is a possible universe, so those are values of these parameters in units of the values in our universe. So you see, so you've got consumption constant at the 17 times what we have, the same lepton number as in our universe, no dark matter at all, much smaller amplitude of fluctuations, and it's called Big Bang, which much less photons per baryon in our universe. And he claims that this passes all the entropic cuts with flying colors, and it's called no problem. So in other words, local perturbations around the value of our parameters are not enough. If you want to play this game, you should play this game in this huge parameter space. And this, that's a paper by Tenmark et al. And they list 31 different fundamental constants. And they say, well, we should buy all of them. Then they go on and just buy three of them. But in principle, you should play this game at all. After all, if lambda is allowed to vary across the multiverse, why shouldn't the others vary as well? But that's a point that I'm going to discuss in more detail. But I think it's a very valid criticism.
Yeah, right, 17 is this case, not 20, for instance. Because you understand that 1017 means the cosmic constant became dominant much before even combination.
That's right.
Yeah, it's one of the things.
But
the second thing, it means that the galaxy density built is there because it could have to be formed before you, yeah?
I think the point of his work was that at the same time you have to turn down, you have 10 to the max, so you have the entropy per baryon much smaller than what we have in our universe. So it's a cold Big Bang cosmology. And so all the evolution of galaxies is completely changed because radiation domination, perturbations can start growing immediately in this cosmology because radiation domination ends much before than in our universe. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and what is the main critical ingredient for this number? How it was obtained? Why it's 1017 but not 10 minus 10^20, for instance, or 20?
I don't know, I think that's just a point that we found in this proper space.
Nuclear synthesis or star formation, or what is?
Yes, nuclear synthesis, it's also the also changed, but you can get all the conditions on the galaxy formation, from the elements abundance and things like that, and it gets it all right. So it's an interesting work. Very interesting.
So how many consistent parameter sets did he find?
Sorry?
How many consistent parameter sets did he find? I mean, you showed us only one.
Yes. Well, he's got a few examples in the paper. He values these five parameters at the same time on the grid, and then he picks out a few different points at the same time. Points that are okay.
But what is the order of magnitude of consistent parameter sets you would get?
Oh, it can be widely. You have widely different corners of this parameter space. And of course, they are separated by regions where it's a no-go region, but there are corners which are okay in very, very different regions of this parameter space. It's not a continuous distribution, I think.
But like in terms of lambda, what is really the spread?
It doesn't do this kind of analysis because it doesn't give you a probability distribution for lambda. That's not something. It's more of a point of principle. Okay, let's see. I'm going to give you now a different, so that's one point. And now I'm going to give you a different reason why I think apart from method probabilistic reasoning that I might touch upon in a minute if I have time, but this is again another point of a very practical point. I'm not saying there's something wrong with the selection effect by itself. I'm saying there's something wrong in the way we can apply this in a consistent and correct way. So let me just, quite apart from the fact which parameters you should vary and how you select a prior, etc., let me focus on the selection function here. So I'm going to just use the same setup as it's usually used in the literature. I'm going to change only lambda, fixing all the other parameters. I'm going to take this probability time distribution to be flat, as people usually do. I'm just going to do a mild tweak at the way the selection function is computed. Instead of taking the probability of life to be proportional to the number of galaxies or the number density of collapsed baryons in structures, I am going to change my definition of observers. So, in particular, I'm going to introduce this, instead of counting observers, I'm going to count observations, because that's a physical quantity that we can compute reliably over the lifetime of the universe. And it's much better defined than some civilizations for which we don't really have anything we don't know much. We just have our old sample to go by. So it's very difficult to predict which civilizations will arise and when observers will arise in not just in our own universe, but even in wider different universes. So what Glenn and I suggested is to use the maximum number of observations that you can in principle carry out in a lambda bigger than zero universe. So if you consider the maximum amount of energy that an observer can gather in a positive lambda universe, then you will see that this is given by the minimum between two quantities. So the first quantity here is essentially the volume of the sphere centered around the observer when the observer starts collecting energy around it. So this is a picture where you've got observers in the universe and they start sending out collecting machines that will collect energy by harvesting non-relativistic matter in the universe, in the sphere around them. And so the maximum energy that you can collect scales is the cube of the conformal time difference between when you start collecting energy and time where the scale factor of the universe becomes infinity, times the scale factor of when you start collecting. So it's just a sphere around us at the moment when we start collecting energy, and gives us a maximum energy we can in principle collect and use to perform observations in the universe. Or, and that's only the case where the sphere is doesn't touch upon another sphere centered on a different observer. So that's a rare observer limit where we got one observer with this sphere going out for time, and the other observers are far away enough that the two spheres do not intersect. If the spheres do intersect, then the limit is given by the inverse density of observers. And so that's a difficult one, because if you don't compute this one, we need to compute the density of observers again, and this is a very difficult situation. So what we do, we concentrate on this case where we got this rare observer limit. Every observer in the universe is allowed to collect as much energy as it likes within its sphere of influence, the future causal sphere, essentially. And then we can compute the maximum number of thermodynamical processes that you can do in this universe, given this amount of energy that you have collected. So this is bounded from above by the maximum energy that you've collected, but divided by the minimum temperature at which you can expand this energy, which is at the center temperature when the universe has reached lambda domination. So this number here is the maximum number of thermodynamic processes that you can do in a lambda universe, and it's bounded by three facts. One fact is bounded by the maximum energy you can access and collect. And the second bound is given by the inverse of the center temperature, which scales as lambda. So this is bounded by the value of the cosmological constant.
So why is this formula?
Sorry?
What is the argument why the center temperature should come?
Because we define one observation as one single thermodynamic process. So the thermodynamic process is given by the temperature, sorry, the energy that you have divided by the maximum efficiency is given by the energy divided by the minimum temperature at which you can carry out the process. And the minimum temperature that you can get is the temperature when the universe has become lambda dominated and it's reached a uniform density temperature, which is the minimum temperature it's going to reach for the cosmological constant. So
you consider this temperature, the temperature is real temperature.
Yeah. Yes, like a lower bound on the temperature at which you can operate the thermodynamic system in the universe. Yeah?
But this is the maximum number of observations, what, the unit volume for what?
Per observer. Assuming that observers do not overlap, the spheres of influence where you can collect energy do not overlap in this rare observer unit limit. And this is integrated over the lifetime of the universe.
Supposing there was no city temperature, supposing our world had no cosmological constant at all?
Right, then, yes. This is only valid for lambda strictly larger than zero, yes.
But if there would be no temperature,
that would be infinite.
It would be infinite.
Yes, but what we are trying to say here is that we want to find the lower bound of the probability distribution for lambda. Now, if lambda is allowed to go to zero or even to go negative, there will be some probability that will speed on the other side. So actually, by restricting ourselves to the case where lambda is bigger than zero, we are being conservative. Okay? Because what I want to compute here is the probability to leave the universe above a certain value of lambda.
Well, I understand, but supposing the considered temperature was a zillion orders of magnitude smaller than, let's see.
Yeah.
Would then say that n maximum becomes enormously large?
Yeah. So this means that you'd be enormously more probable to live in such a universe
well,
than now.
I don't understand what it is, what n max is.
Yeah, but look, in some sense, I think I wouldn't care concerning all these observations about cosmological constant, even today, and about all these thermodynamical processes. It's so negligible.
No, but you want to integrate over all
no, exactly.
future history.
I want to integrate, yes, yes, yes. Yes, because what I'm saying is, yeah, if you condition on the number of the fraction of gas which is in galaxies today, it might be, you know, it might be that typical galaxies in a certain universe last a billion years, and in different universes will last 10 billion years. So you're missing out on all the future
so
evolution.
So they will be okay, thrown away from us, and in future you'll see less and less things.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yes, yeah, yeah, that's right. Yes, actually, yes, stuff will zoom away from us to the accelerated expansion. We'll miss out on all.
What if there is no cosmological constant? Aren't we limited by the fact that the universe is expanding and diluting?
Yeah. If there is no cosmological constant, then
let's suppose we're in an FRW expanding. Eternally expanding universe.
Yeah. But since there is only one horizon.
Yeah, exactly. In this case,
I know.
Yes, yes.
You think that observations can go on and on and
I know, but that's a big point.
Pools,
but the problem with this is the usual problem with probability. If you live in an infinite universe, in this case, if you have an infinite time to collect energy, probability is not defined whenever you've got infinite divided by infinite, probability itself is not defined. So it's very hard to give any probabilistic statement.
Are you assuming we're in a finite universe?
Sorry?
Are you assuming we're in a finite universe?
No, I'm just assuming that there is a conformal time in which our escape path goes to infinity. That the horizon size is finite, in other words.
This issue of not having cosmological constant. There is a possible way of explaining the acceleration of the universe through big time and homogeneity.
Mm-hmm.
And you can simply do the lower redshift being the higher redshift being supernova.
Yes.
You have an electrical field H, which is called higher redshift.
Yeah.
There's no disproof of this being, no proof that this is incorrect.
So your
cosmological constant is zero.
Yeah.
You don't need.
That's by using the Hubble bubble thing. Is that the Hubble bubble you're talking about?
Yes, the voids and galaxies.
Yeah.
If you remove them,
then
you don't see an accelerating universe.
For the supernova data.
There's no principles problem.
For the supernova data, but can you explain the CMB data at the same time?
So, well, this is an issue that's could be investigated. But this is a model.
Yeah.
You're basing everything on a model. Maybe the model of lambda being
no,
is wrong.
I agree on that. But what I'm trying to show here is that I'm just trying to make a counterexample to the usual use of selection effects. I'm not saying that this is the way of doing it. I'm just saying it's as plausible as anything else. And if you buy what people usually do, then I claim that you should buy this as well, and I'm going to show you in a second what difference it makes on the results. So it's a different argument.
Another issue is on the long time to basis. Everything is dependent on the cosmological constant calculation of the quantum truth.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, it's wrong by 122 orders of magnitude. But this may be due to our ignorance of how to calculate back in the take the case of superconductivity.
Mm-hmm.
It was discovered experimentally in 1911 by Kami Kamalinonis. It took 50 years to theoretically understand the temperature superconductivity. And during that time, we didn't invoke the anthropic principle to explain low temperature superconductivity.
Right.
So maybe we're being impatient here. We're trying to change all the physics because we don't understand how to calculate vacuum energy.
Maybe. I personally don't pencil.
But that's not the point he's arguing for. he's arguing, suppose you have a cosmological constant, people come up with this entropic principle to explain, in quotation marks, the coincidence problem, and he's arguing that we do it in the wrong way. He's not in favor for the cosmological constant or not.
No, I think that's right. That's exactly right. I'm giving a technical argument here why I think the way selection effects are implemented is incorrect.
I'm not criticizing you.
No.
I'm criticizing the present way physics is done.
I take your point, but I think it's a valid point. I personally don't have much sympathy for this idea of having this collection of invisible and unobservable universes lying around. It doesn't seem to be much of an explanation to me. But if you buy this framework, and I'm trying to show that different ways of doing this, the same calculation, will lead to a completely different result. In my opinion, this undermines the predictivity, the claimed predictivity of this procedure. And then you can argue whether the procedure by itself is reasonable or not. That's a separate issue, I agree.
So we should not forget that we have only 7 minutes left. So.
No, I'll wrap it up now, I think, just so I'm going to present the result and then.
Yeah, but this seems to be your absolutely central point.
Yeah.
I understand all the symbols, but I don't understand the connection.
The connection with what?
I don't understand why the number of observations
yes.
goes to infinity
yes.
as the Sitter temperature goes to zero. I would have thought that if the Sitter temperature goes to zero, we still live in an expanding universe, everything cools, everything gets colder and colder and colder, we die the heat death of the earth.
Yes, that's right, yes.
yes. And I don't understand
why. This equation here assumes a strictly positive lambda. You're right. If lambda is not strictly positive, then you have to modify this argument. But what I'm saying is, if...
Suppose it's 10 to the minus 10 to the minus...
Yeah, it's useful. From where is this formula comes? It's some kind of assumption you did, or what is the reason for writing this formula?
The reason for writing this formula is to get rid of the problem of observers. The reason for writing this formula is to try and say, okay, let's count observations on the lifetime of the universe instead, because we don't know how to compute observers. Now, if you say that...
it's for squared, for instance, etc.
Well, this formula here. Oh, well, because, no, but that's it. So then, okay, if you define...
Or one over it.
This formula is perfectly well defined, right? It's just the energy amount that you have divided by the energy cost of making one thermodynamical process. That's it. That's just what it is.
Yeah, but I do not understand.
It's perfectly well defined.
Just the number of thermodynamic processes.
Yeah, that's linked with the number of observations in principle you can perform in that universe. What I'm trying to say is that the universe which has got an n max which is larger. Let me just say, if n max is larger in a certain universe, then we expect that there is the possibility of carrying out more observations of lambda over the entire lifetime. And therefore, probabilistically speaking, this universe should wait for more.
Okay?
Let's
assume that I bought it.
Let's assume
for a minute.
Okay, yeah.
But then, I think your result
yes.
for this
yes.
for probability
yes.
will crucially depend
yes.
what stands on the right-hand side here. Because you could put there any function, which is the ratio of E maximum divided by T. So why it should be linear function in this?
Why do you want to put any function?
Exponent, I could put exponent. So why exponent in E max divided by kT is versus as a linear function?
I think you don't have the freedom to change the linear dependence of this, because that's you're just looking for the number of processes. Right? You're not looking for the square of these processes.
From where this formula comes, is there something in thermodynamics?
Yeah, it's just the thermodynamical cost of one observation. Yeah, that's right. That's the maximum. You get the maximum efficiency for a given energy amount. You get the maximum efficiency of the thermodynamical process you get when the cold reservoir temperature is lower. Okay, that's it. Okay, let me just wrap it up, and then I'm very happy to continue the discussion afterwards. So the main point of this is, if you buy this idea that we get rid of observers and we instead take into account the maximum number of observations that one observer can carry out over the life of the universe, Let's forget about this. And also, let me just point out that there is a correspondence between observations and observers. If we assume that every observer, every civilization has got a certain constant amount of observations to spend on the life of the universe, then the two schemes are equivalent, up to the fact that our scheme integrates on the lifetime of the universe. So it should count, certainly it's important to count what happens in the future of the universe. Perhaps we are early arrivals and therefore we are not typical. So if you buy this idea, this is what you get as a result. Right, so that's probability density as a function of R, where R is the ratio of lambda in whatever multiverse we're considering to the binary universe, so the argument sits at 1. And this thing here grows as 1, as R to the minus 1. So it's diverging for R to 0, so we cut it off at a small value of lambda, as motivated perhaps by the fact that we have this 10 to the 500 different realizations in the landscape of string theory, so we cut it down at a small value. But however you cut it, this prefers the small values of lambda for the reason that if lambda is more, then t is smaller, and also the universe expands less fast, so you can collect more energy. And so this is widely different from what we saw before, when the peak is around here. You see that all the probabilistic weight is here at a very small value, and we also introduce this parameter tau, which controls when observers arrive in the universe. So tau equal 1 is our universe, 0.1 is the universe where observers start collecting energy at the 10th of the present time, and 10 is if you wait for longer, and then you can start collecting energy 10 times the age of the universe. What you find in this scheme is that the probability that R is bigger than 1 in our universe is very small, 10 to the minus 5, for the reason, the physical reasons that I gave you before. So let me just conclude. I just want to say this here is a way of saying that if you change, even if you buy the entropic principle, the selection effect, and I didn't have time to go to the probability argument that, for which I think, well, actually, Radford Lin pointed out, it's inconsistent reasoning, and if you're interested, we can discuss this later. But if you're happy to dismiss those criticisms of fundamental probability theory, if you change the way you define observers in a rather mild way, then you get completely different answers. So what you put in is very much what you get out. In our opinion, this suffers from a strong lack of predictivity.
So 10 minus 5 probability to see what we see today.
All larger. Yeah.
So what you argue that it should be much smaller.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly, that's the result. Okay, let me.
And Williamson got that it should be 0.7,
yes.
0.8, and yes. As maximum of the probability distribution at this point.
Yes. But this is, first of all, a condition,
but also if you know this result depends on the a priori distribution of the cosmological constant.
We took it to be flat as everybody else does.
As everybody. So it's flat, not on logarithmic scale, it's flat
in lambda.
Yes.
That's right. But you see, people say it's flat in lambda because then they go on with a secret argument. It's flat in lambda. Since we get a peak in a very small window, then it's fine to assume it's flat. So it's not a secret. In our case, we don't get a peak. And so this assumption becomes very, very important again.
Yes.
So, yes.
If you take, for instance, flat in logarithmic scale, then you will get that it should be strict equals zero.
Yeah, and you get even steeper. Yes, you're right. Yeah.
No, it could be zero. Yes. You got very steep, and there would be infinity because it would be divergent.
But this is divergent as well. This is divergent.
This is divergent as well.
Yes, as R minus 1. So it's cut.
Ah, there.
It is.
Then you predict in fact that.
As low as it gets.
Look, as low, you predict precisely equal cosmology, equal zero cosmology.
It diverges.
It diverges. If you would not make cut offs,
then. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Just a minute. All this comes all from integrating over time.
Yeah. From yes.
How much time are we talking about?
Right. So we're talking about the only parameter is when you start integrating, right? The parameter is when you start and then you integrate into.
It's in fact perhaps coming from the fact that lambda comes in the numerator somewhere when you write the limit on the number of the.
As well, but there is dependence also in the numerator. It's a combined effect.
But how much time in the future is this factor?
Well, that depends on the value of lambda.
On which?
On the value of lambda, depends on the value of lambda itself. something that we can carry on the discussion later. Can I just give you a quick, very quick summary? So we've got this stability problem. We don't know which parameter we should vary. There's no argument that we don't have time to go through. So in conclusion, I think this is the question we would like to answer. What I'm interested in understanding is whether God did have a choice in creating the universe, as Einstein said. But if failing that, perhaps we can go with Woody Allen and say, if only God would give me some clear sign, like making a large positive material in Swiss bank. An alternative explanation. OK, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
The energy that you calculate, like the one belonging to the observer, well, the one that allows an observation, right?
Okay.
I didn't quite understand. Is it the energy that collapses in a linear?
No, that's the energy of matter within your future causal horizon. That you can, if you send out probes at the speed of light to go and gather this energy, so it's essentially the energy within your future life. In terms of the macro density.
No, because I mean there should be some crucial stuff when a body collapses for gravitationally. I guess thermodynamics is much more.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's fine, it's not that you can calculate exactly.
No, no, exactly. It's just a bound. Yes.
It's just a bound.
Yeah.
So it's conservative.
Getting back to this issue, I think it's very other costs, which I agree with. There was a time when I was a student when people obsessed trying to calculate the differential neutral mass difference for quantum field theory. In fact, I actually contributed to this. And all these calculations really failed. So we tried to calculate the cosmological cost to back to the energy. We don't really know how to do that. So here we're doing all of this stuff with land. The flight structure cost. Pauling always obsessed with effect Pauling. He's always obsessed with the fact how do we calculate one of the ones we set. There's the joke that he gets to heaven. He says to Peter at the gates, he says this, he says to Pauling, do you have anything to say? Yes, I have a question. How do you calculate the flight structure cost? So maybe we're being too presumptuous about the question. We don't know how to calculate vacuum energy. We don't really understand vacuum energy. And yet we're trying to change physics by doing it. Because of it.
Yes, if you had a better fundamental explanation, there wouldn't be no need.
You've got land, you've got land everywhere.
Yes. Yes. If you ask in favor for the transfer, we have to show that that mark cannot be affected.
I agree. The onus is on the components. Yes. Yes.
Possible to prove.
Yes.
That's impossible.
And even if you have these peaks in exactly the right place, would anybody believe it?
Yeah.
Not only is it impossible to prove, but maybe one should pursue this in the first place. Okay?
That's not going to
pursue everything. Once you pursue everything, if some young person comes along and explains why the cosmological constant is 10^-125.3, I assure you, I and everyone else, Steven Weinberg, Joe Polchinski, Martin Rees, Alan Guth, Andre Linde, Raphael Busso, Jim Peebles, will all immediately say, forget the anthropic constant.
Are you sure about that?
Yes.
Do you want to put endorse this?
Yes.
What about an old physicist explaining it? Because it must have to be a young one. But as I said, it took 50 years to understand simple things. What temperature should be conducted?
All ideas have to be explored, period.
Yeah, but this is being explored by a lot of people.
It was explored by
including you.
It was explored by almost nobody because there was a violent reaction in the physics community against it on the basis that it was religion. So nobody explored it. now it's being explored. This is a good thing. It's not a bad thing that people's minds have been opened to a new idea. It does not close down the option of looking for other explanations.
Can I just say once more, just to be very, very clear, that I'm not saying that this is intrinsically wrong or intrinsically flawed. I'm saying that I got technical points about the way this is done.
I understand what you're doing.
Right.
The lesson is keep your mind open. The physics community's mind was so completely closed to this, and it was close to it to the point of anger. Meanwhile, things were happening. Things were happening. The cosmological constant was being detected. Look, 20 years ago, whenever it was that Weinberg made his prediction, I personally said to myself, look, this is probably wrong, but there are three things that are needed in order to make some sense out of it. The first would be that we would have to have a theory in which, first would be that a cosmological constant would be detected in the range that Weinberg said. The second would be that we would have to have a theory with a very, very large number of possibilities so that we would be likely to have something in this range. And the third would be that we would have some mechanism to populate the universe with a large number of possibilities. My own attitude at the time was, if all of these three things emerge, then you have to take it seriously. You have to take it seriously and start questioning whether it could be the right answer. All three things happen. And so you can't dismiss it. You can't dismiss it. You can't just say, look, this is bad stuff. Don't think about it. Close it down. It's dangerous. My friend David Gross, who's a very good friend of mine, says it's dangerous. Dangerous. The biggest danger is to say that ideas are dangerous.
So what is the argument? Why is it dangerous?
He sees two dangers. The first is that young people will stop looking for the true answers. I doubt that very much. I don't think young people will stop looking for anything. Maybe you're right, but that speaks very poorly then of the young generation of physicists. I hope it's not true.
They have to find jobs, maybe.
The second danger that I saw was this would disarm us in front of our enemies. Our enemies being the religious establishment. That once we admit to this possibility, we are then vulnerable to attack from the religious community. This is a political. First of all, it's not true. If you look at what the religious community has to say about me, it's not very nice. Apart from that, this is not a scientific argument, this is some sort of ideological argument. If you ask them, do you see any physics or any science arguments against this? No, not at all. Do you see any better options scientifically? No, I don't. Do you see any hope that at the present time right now that anybody's going to explain that 10 to the minus r in 23? No, I don't. So, you know, the response that you're seeing now to it is a response to an extreme negativism, a kind of negativism about these ideas, which I think was just unwarranted. And it was based on some kind of idea that these ideas were dangerous, religious, would disarm us in front of a religious community, and so forth. And I think it's a healthy thing that the ideas have been opened up and now are being explored.
Yeah, but it's possible it's nonsense.
It's possible that everything is nonsense.
No, not everything in physics is nonsense.
No. Everything that we think about these things, of course it's possible it's nonsense. Of course it's possible it's nonsense.
Now, I'm glad to hear that you admit this possibility.
Of course it's possible, it's nonsense.
Last question, then we...
I very much appreciate trying to calculate if something is vaguely defined as life and trying to calculate something which is more physical. There's a technical question about that. You said it's in the rare observer limits. Does that mean that this Emax keeps increasing for all time?
It means that this Emax increases as much as it can without. You see, because if you have dense observers, then the sphere of influence of each observer will overlap, and then at some point there's a region where you've got to share resources, and this brings in all sorts of issues. What will happen when observers will collide, and will they share resources, and will they snatch the
resources? So you can't show that Emax increasing without limits.
Well, it increases up to the limit where the horizon size can increase, and then it stops.
Okay.
You're assuming that the energy can be gathered and brought back, is that right?
No, if it is brought back, there are geometrical two factors in front of this. I've got a proportionality sign. In this area, if you gather the energy and you use it in place where you gather it, or if you bring it back to the origin, there are geometrical prefactors.
Well, you can't have the energy too distributed because you've got to be able to send signals back and forth between.
But it's just a numerical factor. If you want to send it back, this is reduced by some proportionality factor, which is just a constant which does not depend on time.
So that's right.
Yeah. So it doesn't matter. I mean, for government by itself, it doesn't matter what you send it back.
That's the assumption that you can gather energy,
yeah,
and you can gather all the available energy that's available
to you.
And the upper bound on the radius is the decision.
Yeah. That's right. So and then if you want to bring it back, it costs you a factor of one.
Why don't you start with that? Why don't you also consider Boltzmann brains?
Oh, that's another interesting possibility, but I don't know. I was a bit skeptical about that one.
I'd be the first to admit that there's an enormous confusion about how you do the statistics properly, what the right measure is, and if the whole business is vulnerable, it's vulnerable at that level, that everything that you calculate is infinite over infinite.
Oh, well, yes, that's a very constant breakdown.
Once everything is infinite over infinite, you can get any answer you want. This
right.
is true.
Yeah.
The whole thing can fail if nobody can make sense out of statistics.
So perhaps we can have a chat after this about this other argument, which I think we can have a chat about this other argument about statistics that I didn't have time to present, but you might be interested in discussing. There's this argument about fundamental principles in statistics and how consistent logical reasoning requires certain properties of the statistical reasoning, and we can discuss them all.
What do you think of the proposal of Gusso?
Officials.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, you can go on.
We can cross move over and continue.
It's not like a form. You will be here all the time, right?
I'll be here tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you very much again.